said.
It will do,
Mrs. Mellick repeated in a tone that said it would be the last time. Mr. Mellick sighed heavily and told Kitty to bring the jug of cider as well. A moment later, Kitty had the platter, a 2-foot-square wooden plank painted cheerfully with handles carved onto the ends, and an earthenware jug with a stopper in the top. Martin took the platter, but Donald Sr. had hoisted himself from his bench and took possession of the jug.
Let's go, he said.
My master told you what is happening in the shed is not for your eyes, Martin said.
No, your master said very little, and it's a good thing because I didn't invite him here. The father told me, and I'm not listening. It's my shed and it's my cider, so I'm going to see what you're all up to.
Jan Mellick was furious.
It's your son, Donald!
That do. Let's go, apprentice. Time's wasting.
Mr. Mellick started toward the door. As Martin reluctantly followed him, he was stopped by Mrs. Mellick's hand on his arm. She looked Martin in the eye and asked in a small voice,
Will he be all right?
Martin stopped, and in his calmest, most serious voice said,
Your son will be fine.
He followed Mellick out the back door. As Mr. Mellick opened the back door, a hot wind blew in. As they stepped out of the house, the wind was strong enough to make walking difficult. The wind seemed to be coming from the shed, along with horrible growling, howling noises. Every crack in the shed's structure seemed to ooze a harsh red light. Under the other sounds, you could just make out both Philip and Bishop Galbraith yelling, the priest in Latin, Philip in Esperanto. Mr. Mellick stopped for a moment, shielding his eyes from the wind and light. Then he ran into the wind toward the shed. Martin shouted,
Wait, let me go first!
Donald jerked the shed door open, and for a moment he was blinded. When his eyes adjusted, he saw his son floating in the middle of the shed, a full foot off the ground. He seemed to be struggling mightily. His limbs were flailing. Red light was coming from his eyes, nose, and mouth. He was throwing his head around as if he was yelling, but the only sound was an inhuman animal roaring. He was enveloped in a glowing energy field coming from Philip's staff. Bishop Galbraith held his crucifix toward the boy. A beam of white light shot from the crucifix, hitting the boy in the heart. All three of them looked at the door as if they were caught doing something naughty. They saw Mr. Mellick frozen in terror. The whole world seemed to pause for a moment, except Martin, who gently took the jug from Donald's hand and stepped well back. The man gasped.
Son?
The red light dissipated from the boy's eyes, nose, and mouth. He saw the concern in his father's face. He said,
Dad!
Then the red light came back. The boy opened his mouth and projectile vomited with enough force to cover the distance between father and son without a single globule hitting the ground. Mr. Mellick tried to run, sliding on the muck with which he was drenched. He ran straight for the back door of the house. He darted inside, and as the door slammed shut behind him, Martin heard the sound of 4 women shrieking. The priest lowered his crucifix. The beam of white light did not lower with it.
Well, that went better than expected, he said.
As Martin came into the shed and closed the door, Philip said,
Fino program!
And all of the mystical light and sound faded away. Donald gently descended to the floor. Martin looked at a patch of the fake vomit that had splashed off of Donald the Elder. He looked at Philip.
Stew?
He said. Philip shrugged.
It's what Monty Python uses.
Bishop Galbraith took the platter from Martin.
Well done, everybody,
he said.
Particularly you lads. You both did well for your first exorcism, and now we move on to the most important part.
Philip took 4 of the pieces of firewood that passed for furniture and arranged them in a rough diamond in the floor. Then he took 3 more pieces and arranged them in a triangle pattern inside the larger diamond. Bishop Galbraith placed the platter on top of the triangle and put the jug of cider on the platter. The bishop sat on one of the 4 chunks of wood that formed the diamond. He beckoned Donald to sit opposite him and Martin to sit to his right. Philip sat to the bishop's left and removed his hat. He reached into his hat and one by one produced 4 drinking glasses.
The bishop and I are now going to teach the 2 of you,
Philip said, reaching into his hat one last time.
How to play pinochle.
Philip pulled a deck of cards out of the hat. 18.
If you're going to make macros and use the shell,
Philip said,
I suppose you'll need a computer you can do real work on, not that phone that has more computational memory than every computer at MIT the year I graduated, combined. Perhaps you should pop back to your time and get your computer.
I can't, Martin said. The last time I saw it, it was being dismantled by federal agents.
And it only took you a week to get into that much trouble?
Philip asked.
All the trouble happened in the last 2 days. I spent the days leading up to that setting myself up for failure.
Preparation is the key to success. Or, in this case, the opposite,
Philip said.
I guess you'll have to get a new computer.
Drat. I do hate buying brand new computers, Martin said in a sarcastic monotone.
I know, right? It's just a burden you'll have to bear,
Philip responded in kind. Martin opened the settings dialog on the smartphone app. It felt like he had lived a lifetime since he created it. Back then, it had seemed like an unnecessary detail to allow himself the ability to change where and when the phone was broadcasting from on the fly. But now, he was glad he had gone to the trouble. He set the phone's time for a week before he fled his own time, applied the new settings, and opened the Amazon.com app. Walter and Margarita Banks stood in their living room, trying to understand what was happening. Their son Martin was acting very strangely. There were sirens blaring from their yard, and someone had just pounded rather insistently on the front door. They looked at the door, then looked at each other, then looked at Martin when he stuck his head out of his bedroom door and said,
Hi, just checking, what's the capital of England?
Margarita answered.
London?
Martin slammed the door shut again. Whoever was pounding on the front door yelled,
We are federal agents! Open this door immediately!
Walter went to open the door, but only made it a step before Martin burst out of his bedroom again.
Don't open that door! Not yet!
Martin said. Walter froze.
Have any packages been delivered for me?
Yes, you got 2 boxes from Amazon yesterday. They're in the kitchen,
Margarita replied.
Awesome,
Martin said, almost singing as he ran to the kitchen. Then he stopped.
Wait, what, 2 boxes?
His mother pointed at the floor next to the back door, and there were 2 boxes from Amazon. Martin could tell from the shape of the boxes which one he had ordered. The second box was a mystery. The voice from beyond the front door shouted,
Open this door, or we will break it down!
Martin knew that there was a limit to how much material he could reliably transport back in time, so the mystery box would just have to wait for another time, when he would probably know what it was anyway. He picked up his order and ran back to his room.
What kind of trouble are you in, son?
Walter asked.
No trouble, Dad. Everything's cool. Just don't open the door yet!
Martin said as casually as he could as he ran back into his room and slammed the door behind him. Martin rematerialized in the crystal ballroom of Philip's shop, hugging his Amazon.com box to his chest. Philip had explained that transporting anything too large was a risky proposition. Large objects are usually just a collection of small objects held together by glue, screws, or clips, which are themselves just smaller objects.
More than one wizard has filled a suitcase with stuff, teleported, and materialized holding nothing but a handle.
So keep it small, Martin had said.
Yes, and just to be safe, try to hug it when you teleport. Surround the item as best you can with your limbs. Make more than one trip if you must.
So hug the box Martin had, and the box seemed to make the trip just fine. Martin's favorite part of buying a new computer was unboxing and setting up the system for the first time. This time it was even better because he was experiencing it through Philip's eyes, a man from 1984. The most advanced piece of hardware Philip had ever seen, aside from Martin's phone, was Gary's 1994 Apple PowerBook. When Martin unboxed the brand new 2012 laptop that looked like it was carved from a single billet of aluminum, Philip looked like his head was going to explode. Martin couldn't help smiling as Philip read the specifications on the side of the box, his lips moving slightly as if he were a linguist trying to read the Rosetta Stone. Philip shook his head.
I understand all of these specs, but the numbers are all so large. I don't know what any of it means. What on earth can a person do with 4 gigabytes of RAM?
Upgrade it immediately, Martin answered. Martin was delighted to see that the laptop had shipped with a partial charge on the battery, so Martin was able to boot it up and show Philip how modern operating systems worked, how high-definition movies looked, what 3D games were, and how fast the computer could perform tasks. Philip was visibly grateful and insanely jealous.
I could maybe get you one if you want, Martin offered.
Philip sighed.
No, I wouldn't know how to use it. I'd best stick with my Commodore. It fits my, you know, my computing style. Besides, I'll be able to get my own shiny new computer eventually, if I wait around long enough. That's the beauty of being immortal. You learn to appreciate delayed gratification.
Instead of learning the Shell's scripting language, they spent the rest of that day setting up and optimizing Martin's new computer. Thanks to the Shell, it was much easier to find the new laptop's entry in the file. All Philip had to do was point at it and say, "Statisticoi," and the entry came up on the Commodore 64 screen.
Statisticoi. That means statistics, doesn't it?
Martin asked.
Yup.
Does Esperanto ever remind you of Pig Latin?
Yes. By the way, Esperanto for Pig Latin is Porco Latina.
They set the laptop's battery to constantly be full, like Martin's phone. For internet access, Martin simply used Wi-Fi to tether the laptop to his phone so he could access the phone's 4G connection, a process that thoroughly confounded Philip. Martin patiently talked Philip through it as they went. He enjoyed playing teacher to Philip's student instead of the other way around. The next morning, after a bowl of breakfast stew, they set up the laptop on the table in Philip's house and settled in to get access to the Shell. The Shell was hosted redundantly on many corporate and government servers, just like the file itself. Because they knew what to search for, they found what they were looking for pretty fast. They downloaded a version of the Shell interface that was designed for Windows XP. It was badly outdated from Martin's point of view, but it worked in emulation and was stable. The interface had large, cartoonish icons Martin could use to access the raw file, a sandbox for creating new powers and effects, a library of pre-existing powers and effects, and a graphical interface for combining them and assigning a trigger. Philip was explaining how to stack several effects to create the illusion of a single, unified effect when Martin felt a sudden chill.
Perfect timing, as always.
Philip groaned.
Huh, I've got goosebumps, Martin said.
Yes, so have I. Sit back, kiddo. You're about to see a textbook example of how many different effects can be layered to make an impression on your audience. In this case, to give the impression that the wizard is trying far too hard to impress.
A breeze blew through the room, seeming to blow inward from all 4 of the walls, converging on a point in the middle of the room. The wind formed a small whirlwind, which grew and darkened as more dust, far more than had been in the room to begin with, was drawn into the vortex. All light in the room dimmed until it looked like midnight in the dead of winter, rather than a sunny fall morning. As the light died, a glow emanated from the whirlwind, which had formed into the size of a man. There was a deafening sound, like a gas truck exploding, but played in reverse. Then the room was filled with nothing but white light and silence. As Martin's eyes adjusted, he saw a marble statue of an impressive wizard where the whirlwind had been. The statue held its staff aloft with its muscular left arm. Its equally muscular right arm was flexing mightily with its hand at head height, gripping a tiny, brilliant white star as if it were a softball. The statue's square jaw was set, and its facial expression spoke of a serene confidence and a terrible purpose. The statue's flowing hair was blown back, as if it was standing directly in front of a fan. The light in the statue's hand pulsed orange, sending out a shockwave of fire that filled the room. Martin instinctively covered his face with his arms. Philip did not flinch. As the shockwave dissipated, the marble burned away to ash, which fell but seemed to disappear before it hit the floor. As the ash crumbled away, it left behind a real wizard in the same pose. The arms were thinner, the jaw was weaker, the hair was limper. It was, however, the same wizard. His robes were a deep emerald green with gold trim. His staff was black and as shiny as a piano. The figurehead was a small blue electric plasma ball, like teenage guys bought from mall novelty shops in the late 1980s. In an amplified voice with too much reverb, the wizard said,
"Be not afeard! I, Merlin, have appeared!"
Philip groaned, then said,
"Hello, Jimmy,"
without enthusiasm.
"Would it kill you to knock?"
Jimmy smiled.
"Hello, Philip. Lovely to see you. I apologize for not knocking, but as you know, I put a lot of effort into my entrance."
"Clearly."
"Yes, and the whole effect would be spoiled if it was preceded by me meekly knocking on the door and asking if anyone was home. It wouldn't be nearly as impressive now, would it?"
"Do I look impressed now?"
Philip asked.
"Why, no, dear fellow, you never look impressed. That's part of your charm. What if, instead of knocking, you made three sonic booms in the cadence of a person knocking?"
Martin asked.
"Then he could wait for an answer."
Jimmy's eyes widened.
"That's a genuinely good idea. You must be this apprentice I've heard so much about. Pleased to meet you. You can call me Merlin."
Philip muttered,
"Or you can call him Jimmy, which is his name."
"Yes, thank you, Philip. I must say, Martin, I'd heard you were clever. Lots of people tell me their ideas, but I rarely hear one I like. I'm impressed."
"Yes,"
Philip added.
"Someday, when your ears are bleeding because you're being subjected to shave and a haircut played in sonic booms, you'll know you have yourself to thank."
Jimmy and Martin shook hands. Jimmy had a firm grip and a dry hand. He grasped Martin's right elbow with his left hand as they shook. He leaned in close to Martin's right ear, and quietly enough that Philip couldn't hear, but without whispering, asked,
"Is Philip treating you all right, Martin? Is he teaching you what you need to know? He's not making you do all of his housework or anything, is he, Martin?"
"No," Martin replied quietly.
"He's great. We're getting along fine." "Good, Martin,"
Jimmy said, still shaking Martin's hand, leaning in close and almost whispering into his ear.
"If there are any problems, Martin, I want you to contact me. Will you do that, Martin?"
Before Martin could answer, both he and Jimmy were startled by Philip leaning in very close to Martin's other ear and grasping Martin's left shoulder.
"Martin,"
Philip said in hushed tones,
"is Jimmy acting creepy, Martin? Is he making lots of physical contact, Martin, and murmuring directly into your ear hole? Martin, is he saying your name, Martin, more often than any sane person would, Martin? Martin, it's almost as if he read a book on how to cruise chicks at a discotheque, and Martin realized he could apply those lessons to everyone he met. Isn't it, Martin? Martin, Martin, Martin?"
If Martin had been farther from Jimmy's face, he'd have missed the look of irritation that quickly changed to a surprisingly genuine expression of amused good grace. Jimmy released Martin's arm and took a step back, laughing lightly and spreading his arms in a friendly, expansive gesture.
"Now, Philip, if you're not careful, you're going to give Martin the impression that we don't get along."
"We don't,"
Philip said, clenching his fists. Jimmy quite deliberately looked confused.
"Philip, I've always gotten along with you just fine."
"Yes, Jimmy, you get along with me, but I don't get along with you. Partly because you don't recognize that the word we refers to more than just you."
Jimmy laughed.
"Ah, Philip, you are a pistol.
I wish."
After a profoundly uncomfortable silence, Jimmy said,
"Well, I have other stops today. I'm out making the rounds, checking on projects."
He looked directly at Philip.
"The chairman's work is never done."
"We won't keep you,"
Philip replied.
"No, you won't,"
Jimmy said, initiating a second handshake with Martin.
"If I can be of any help, don't hesitate to ask. You'll be a fine addition to our community, Martin, I can tell."
Jimmy raised his staff above his head. Wind blew inward from the perimeter of the room again, converging on Jimmy, blowing his hair and making his robe flap like a flag. Jimmy spoke, but now his voice was louder, fuller, more epic.
And don't worry about the trials, Martin. If you do, you'll psych yourself out and fail, and that would be very bad.
The whirlwind converged and coalesced around Jimmy. There was a blinding light, a loud noise, and then silence. An idealized marble statue of Jimmy stood where the real thing had been. Then it crumbled into ashes that disintegrated before they hit the ground. When the dust cleared, all that was left was a scorch mark on the spot where Jimmy had stood. The scorch was in the shape of an M inside a pentagram. Philip rubbed at the mark with his boot. It wiped away easily.
"It stands for moron," he said as he finished removing it.
"He seems friendly," Martin said.
"Yes, that's the problem with him. He seems friendly."
Martin knew that the wise move would be to leave it alone and get on with their day. He also knew that he wasn't going to do that.
"It's obvious that you detest him."
"Obvious to everyone but him."
"Oh, I think he knows."
Philip turned to face Martin, his eyes full of hope.
"Do you think so? Do you think he knows how I feel? Oh, I hope that's true. Maybe he even feels the same way about me."
"I think he may. What's your deal? Are you mad because he's Merlin and you're not?"
Philip sat down at the table and slumped over, as if tired from the exertion of hating Jimmy.
"No, I hate him because he's not Merlin. There is no Merlin, and there probably never was. Look, when I came to this time, I knew I'd be disguising myself as a wizard, and hoped I'd be known as a good one. I thought that was a pretty good goal. Good enough for me, at least, but clearly not good enough for Jimmy. When Jimmy came back here, it was with the intention of making people recognize him as Merlin, whether they wanted to or not, and he proceeded to scramble countless people's lives so he could bend reality to his will."
"You're angry because he changed the past?"
"Yes. You could boil it down to that."
"But you're changing the past too."
"Yes, but on a much smaller scale and for very different reasons. I made small changes in hopes of making a better life for myself and others. He made huge changes to create a much better life for himself and a slightly better life for everyone else, maybe, if they were lucky. But if not, he's not really bothered."
A long silence passed as Martin tried to understand, and Philip tried to find a more elegant explanation.
"Shortly after I got here, I decided the repository, the file, as you call it, would be much more useful if it had a simplified interface. I started working on the shell. I told Jimmy about it. He helped a little. When new wizards would turn up, he'd show them our shell that we made. Later on, I'd meet new wizards who had met Jimmy first, and they'd ask me what it was like helping Jimmy invent the shell."
"Ah," Martin said. "You want more credit?"
"No, it's not about credit. It's about theft."
"Theft of credit," Martin said.
"Look,"
Philip said.
"The world can be described as a war between two sides. The problem is that everybody has a different idea of what those two sides are. Liberals versus conservatives, Star Wars fans versus Star Trek fans, people who see the world in terms of us versus them, and people who don't. There are thousands of different two kinds of people. The way I see it, civilization is a war between people like me and people like Jimmy."
"Okay. Who are the people like you and who are the people like Jimmy?"
"Martin, did you ever play basketball?"
"Yes."
"Tell me, what's a foul?"
"It's when a player breaks one of the rules. Do it 5 times and you're kicked out of the game. 6 if it's the NBA. Philip smiled.
"Good. The best way I've ever summed up the war as I see it is that one side, our side, sees a foul as being against the rules. And if you do it too many times, you have to be removed. The other side, Jimmy's side, sees fowls as things you're allowed to get caught doing several times. And if you don't, you aren't trying hard enough.
So you're mad at Jimmy because you think his side cheats at life?
Partly. Mostly I'm mad because I'm pretty sure his side is going to win.
They spent the rest of that day covering the creation of macros, and they got a lot of training accomplished. But Philip's mood never really recovered. It wasn't until the next day, after a good night's sleep, that his smile seemed genuine again. In fact, as Philip roused Martin from the hammock, Philip's smile seemed a little too genuine.
"Get up, me lad! I've got something special planned for you today!"
Martin rubbed the sleep from his eyes as he carefully dismounted the hammock.
"What is it? I was hoping to work some more on macros. I have a few ideas."
Philip shrugged theatrically.
"Well, we could spend the day at the computer, if you'd rather, and just leave learning to fly for another day."
"No, no," Martin said, quickly grabbing his staff. "If you think it's time to try flying," he continued, struggling to pull on his robe.
"Then I, as the, student," he stammered, realizing that pulling on the robe would be easier if he weren't holding his staff,
"should defer to your expertise," he said, setting down the staff and successfully donning his robe.
"And learn to fly today."
Martin had gone from sleep to standing, ready to leave, in 10 seconds and one run-on sentence.
"Now, now, don't be so hasty. You haven't had any breakfast," Philip said. "Here, have one of these. It should tide you over until lunch."
He handed Martin a palm-sized rectangle of something wrapped in cloth.
"What is it?" Martin asked.
"It's something I'm experimenting with. Are you familiar with the idea of a breakfast bar?"
Martin unwrapped it eagerly.
"Yeah, in my time we tend to call them energy bars. I didn't know you had chocolate."
"I don't. This is much healthier. It's a block of dried stew."
It did tide Martin over until lunch, in that it made him lose all interest in eating. He and Philip went outside. Philip held out his hand, and Martin willingly put his hand in Philip's. Martin just happened to look down the street and happened to see Kludge staring at him from a distance, but not so great a distance that he couldn't see Kludge smile at noticing that Martin had noticed him. Philip held his staff aloft in his free hand and pointed its top, with a decorative glass bottle of Tabasco sauce, toward the sky. Philip looked upward, said,
"Floogie!"
And they were soaring into the sky. They flew about 15 miles. In modern times, that is not far. But in the Middle Ages, it was a huge distance. They flew over the forest until they came to a large clearing full of tall grass. In the middle of the clearing, two men in wizard robes were waiting for them. As Philip swooped in for a landing, Martin could see that it was Gary and Jeff.
"Guys, good to see you! I didn't know you were going to be here,"
Martin said.
"We wouldn't have missed it,"
Gary said.
"We wizards always come out for an apprentice's first flight."
"Where's Tyler?"
Philip asked.
"Don't know,"
Jeff answered.
"He went out yesterday for some book research and hasn't come back. Some farmer's probably telling him a story about yams that he thinks he can make into a tale of high adventure. He loses track of time."
"He's going to be bummed that he missed your first flight,"
Gary said.
"It's a tradition."
"Yeah," Jeff said. "It's like when they launch a ship by breaking a bottle on its prow."
"But instead of a ship, it's you."
"And instead of a bottle, it's the ground."
"And there's no breaking involved. Just bouncing."
"Bouncing?" Martin asked. "I'm gonna bounce?" Philip shook his head.
"Only if you crash."
"Which means yes,"
Gary added helpfully.
"Don't worry, though,"
Philip said, scowling at Gary.
"Thanks to the various protective spells I applied to you, you can't be injured."
"Oh,"
Martin said, visibly relieved.
"Good. As long as I can't get hurt."
"No, you'll get hurt," Jeff said. "Just not injured. Your skin won't cut and your bones won't break, but you'll still feel pain if you run a knife across your skin, or you get poked hard with something sharp."
"Or if you fall screaming out of the sky at terminal velocity and land on the hard, rocky ground,"
Gary said, stomping on the ground to emphasize its hardness. Philip put his hand on Martin's shoulder.
Don't listen to them, Martin. They're just trying to scare you. Oh, they're not lying. You will probably fall and bounce, and it will smart like mad, but they're just telling you about it to scare you. Now, let's get you up in the air, shall we?
Moments later, Martin was standing alone. The other three wizards were watching him intently, but giving him plenty of room.
All right, Philip said. We fly using our staff.
Rule one, Martin said reflexively. Don't make the obvious joke.
Indeed, Philip said. Have you ever ridden a motorcycle?
Yes.
How'd that go?
I crashed.
This is gonna be great,
Jeff said. Gary giggled.
Ignore them, Philip said. That doesn't just mean today. In general, it's best to ignore them. Anyway, flying is a lot like riding a motorcycle in two ways. It's more about leaning than steering. And if you look at something, you're going to steer into it even if you don't want to. Now, put your hand about halfway down your staff and hold it over your head.
Martin did. Philip said,
good. Now, think of the staff as your controls. Point the head of your staff forward and you go faster. Pull it back, you slow down. Tilt it to the left and you'll bank left. Tilt right, bank right. Tilt your wrist up and you'll angle upward. Tilt your wrist down and you'll angle down. It sounds like a lot to remember, but if you think of it like you're letting your staff lead you, it's very intuitive.
Martin said, kind of like riding a Segway. Philip and Gary said,
what?
At the same moment, Jeff said,
yes.
Martin asked, how fast can we fly?
There's no theoretical limit, but the shell keeps us down to 100 miles an hour, which, believe me, is more than fast enough when you're up there in the wind with nothing but a robe and hat for protection.
Martin took a deep breath, then raised the staff over his head. He held it there for a moment, then lowered it again.
Do I have to say flugy?
He asked.
It's the least dignified magic word ever.
Right now, yes. Later you can make a macro and set any word you like. Make sparkles trail behind you, whatever. During training, we're focusing on basic flight, and to do that, you say flugy.
Martin raised the staff above his head again. He shook the tension out of his left hand, which was hanging by his side, paused a second to work up his nerve, and said,
flugy.
Nothing happened. He was still standing firmly on the ground. He looked at Philip, fearing that he was yet again being messed with. Philip smiled and said,
point the staff upward a bit.
Just a bit!
You want to start slow.
Martin tilted the head of the staff upward, and he smoothly raised about 30 feet, before he panicked and tilted the staff back, stopping all upward progress. He hovered there, oscillating between laughing, shouting, and being too stunned to make a sound. He had known intellectually that he was going to fly at some point, but now he knew that he was flying, and that was a different matter. He was sure it looked like he was hanging by one hand from his staff, but that was not how it felt. It didn't feel like he was weightless either. It felt as if every atom in his body had simply decided it was time to move in the same direction, and that direction just happened to be straight up. He looked down at Philip, Jeff, and Gary. They looked delighted as they cheered Martin on. Philip raised his staff, said,
flugy,
and drifted up to meet Martin. Jeff produced his magic wand, pointed it at the sky, and shot upward with an eerie humming sound and distorted shockwave emanating from the spot where he had stood. Gary whipped his staff around in an arc, chanting,
Mi estas, misera, spectaculo extera.
He held his staff aloft and rose slowly but forcefully on a pillar of black smoke, so thick you could not see through it. Soon all four of them were hovering there, 30 feet in the air.
Okay, Philip said. You've got hovering down. Now it's time to fly. Remember, just sort of point your staff where you want to go. It's that simple.
Martin pointed the staff a degree or two upward, then tilted his wrist downward, and he gracefully leveled off. His staff led, and his body trailed behind. What had been pointing his staff upward now felt like it was leading him forward. He He turned his head to look behind and saw the others following him. He experimented with some turns. He tried gaining and losing altitude. He swooped. He spiraled. He went as fast as he comfortably could, which wasn't all that fast with the wind in his eyes. He shielded his face with his free hand and tried for a high-speed swoop. He swung down within a few feet of the ground, then gave it the spurs as he angled back toward the sky. He was 50 feet in the air and accelerating upward at a steep angle. Between the speed he was moving, the hand shielding his eyes, and the squinting in the wind, he nearly didn't see the duck. Later, Philip told him he probably would have missed the duck entirely if he hadn't reacted, but he had, involuntarily cringing and pulling his staff arm in to shield his face. In doing so, he dropped the staff's airspeed to nearly zero, then to full reverse, banked a hard right turn, and stuck the staff into a steep dive all at the same time. Martin's body cracked like a whip, flinging him out in front of the staff as he lost his grip. Without his hand to hold it, the staff lost all power and tumbled to the ground. Martin's momentum flung him rear-end first directly into the now very startled duck. He and the duck fell earthward. For a crazy moment, it seemed to Martin that he was sitting on the duck, which was horribly undignified for both of them. The duck seemed to agree as it rolled between his legs and up the front of his torso, flapping wildly and quacking like mad the whole way. It bounced off of his face, and for just an instant, Martin was aware of a duck foot in his mouth. Then the duck disappeared from his perception. Martin didn't know where it went and didn't care. He was more concerned with the ground, which was coming up to meet him quite eagerly. As he tumbled, Philip, Gary, and Jeff spun into his field of view, closing on his position very fast. Gary and Jeff seemed to be yelling something. Philip was hurling his staff around like a lacrosse stick and shouting something as well. A blue ball of energy shot from the head of Philip's staff and flew like a line drive, hitting the ground directly in front of Martin. He had just enough time to feel gratitude for Philip for helping him when he needed it. Martin hit the ground full force. The pain was instant and blinding. He bounced into the air and had just enough time to curse Philip before he hit the ground again, this time rolling to a stop. He lay on the ground, groaning. Jeff and Gary landed. Martin raised himself up from the ground and looked around. The spot where he had initially hit the ground was marked with a glowing blue circle. Radiating out from that circle were ever larger concentric blue rings spaced a foot apart. Gary was counting the rings.
12,
Gary said, shaking his head sadly.
That's 4 yards. Jeff, you guessed 13. You were over. I had 9 and Philip had 10, so Philip wins.
The duck slowed him down, Jeff noted bitterly. Guess that means we both owe you a buck.
No, Philip said. To be honest, I lost our other bet this morning. Martin didn't eat the stew bar.
19. Day broke, and Philip and Martin reluctantly got up and puttered around like men do when they're pretending to be awake. Philip ladled the increasingly thick stew into a bowl, which he handed to Martin, muttering something about needing a good breakfast. Martin muttered agreement, walked to the privy, and with the door open, turned strategically so that Philip could see, and poured the stew through the hole. Now that breakfast was sorted, Philip explained that the training was almost over. They only really had one more subject to cover. Then it would be a simple matter of practicing what Martin had learned until they were both sure he was ready for the trials.
"The subject of the day," Philip said, "is basic conjuring. Simply put, the creation of something from nothing. First, a little review. How do you copy an object?"
"You target it by pointing at it, either with your free hand, your staff, or your wand. Then you say, copio objecto, and a copy of the object will appear."
"Any object?"
"No, it has to be small. About 2 feet cubed is the limit. And mechanically simple. Solid objects work best."
"Because?"
"An object with moving parts is actually several objects working together. Copy a rock, you get 2 rocks. Copy a watch, and you'll probably get a spare watch band."
"Well said. How about transporting things?"
Well, all we've discussed is bringing stuff with us when we teleport. Our clothes, the things we're holding, and the things in our pockets seem to come with us naturally, for some reason.
Yes, the program has some way of organizing various objects defined in the file into units, but we've never quite cracked it. It's a bit embarrassing, really, but all of us have been working for all this time, and yet... Anyway, you said you could hold things in your hand and bring them with you when you teleport. Can you bring anything?
No, Martin said. Again, small, simple objects are best. If you do need to transport something larger or more complex, you want to keep it small and hold it in such a way that you're, well, enveloping it, I guess is the best way to put it.
Indeed. Conjuring can best be described as copying something well after the fact, or transporting it from a state of non-existence. Now, when you copy something, you have to target it by pointing. But when creating something out of nothing, you need to define where it will be created. A set predictable place for conjured items to materialize? So, Martin, tell me, what does a wizard need to wear for the shell to recognize him?
Well, we need a staff or a wand.
For?
Philip asked. Targeting, flying, and looking cool.
Go on.
A robe with sleeves that have a cuff circumference of 2 feet?
Why 2 feet?
The shell looks for the cuffs to help it know where your hands are. Makes it easier to program energy beams and effects when you write a macro. Martin answered.
Very good. What else does a wizard wear?
A conical hat that is no less than 1 foot tall.
Do you have to be wearing it?
No, it can be in your hand or your pocket, but it has to be somewhere on your person.
Correct. What does a magician use his hat for?
Philip asked. Martin smiled as he saw where Philip was going.
For pulling things out of.
Top man, yes. The shell looks for the hat and uses it as the default location to materialize created items. There are certain items we figured would be useful to be able to create at will, and we program them into the shell.
Philip held his hat so Martin could see that it was empty. He held it by the brim as if he intended to use it to carry things, and said,
Creimonon.
He reached into the hat and pulled out a gold piece. Then he said,
Creisekigitai bovasho.
Reached into the hat and pulled out a strip of beef jerky, which he handed to Martin.
These are the things that we've hardwired into the shell. You can use your staff to define and save a small item and program a macro to create it later. If the item is small enough, it can be surprisingly complex. Crei rizo kai fazeoloi roligis en omleto.
Philip reached into his hat and pulled out a burrito. He said,
enjoy your beef jerky,
and bit into his burrito.
You could make real food all this time? Martin asked.
Martin,
Philip answered, speaking with his mouth full.
Have you ever once seen me eat any of that stew?
With the basics out of the way, the following days were made up of practice, review, and practical application. Macros were created. Miss Abigail's goat got moved from one pasture to another a few times. The foundations of a life in medieval England got made for Martin. He spent an afternoon creating a tidy war chest of gold pieces. The lesson he learned in his own time still applied here. Having a ready supply of money was as potent a form of magic as any. Martin and Philip looked around Ledchurch for a cottage Martin could buy after he passed the trials. They didn't find anything that excited Martin, but it was fun to look. Finally, the day came to pick up Martin's robe and hat. When Martin and Philip entered Gwen's shop, they found her sitting at her work table, stitching the hem of a tunic. On Gwen's left, there was a small stack of 2 or 3 neatly folded garments. On her right was a massive pile of garments in various contrasting shades of earth tone and oatmeal. As they entered, she tied a knot in the thread she had been pulling. The sleeves of her dark gray cloak were pushed up on her arms, giving the impression that she was putting in some serious effort. She folded the tunic she had just finished and put it atop the larger pile.
You've been busy, Philip said.
Busy, but not profitable. These are all free alterations, and this is just the first batch. That loudmouth Sam starts putting on weight and his waistband can't accommodate his belly anymore. But he can't accept that, so he says his pants have gotten longer. I agree to fix them, really just to get him out of my shop, and he tells everyone who'll listen. Next thing you know, his entire village comes in one by one doing their best Sam impression, and I end up hemming an entire village's worth of clothes for free.
And you'll get to deal with them all again when they come in to pick up their garments, Philip said.
No, when I'm done, I'm just going to go out to their village and get it over with in one trip, she said.
Would you like some help? Martin asked. I could transport you in the pants magically. It might take a few trips, but with both of us carrying pants, it shouldn't be too bad. It'd be a lot faster than driving your cart out there, and I really could use the practice.
Gwen smiled, which made Martin smile, which made Philip smile. Martin's eyes darted over to Philip. Philip quickly frowned and furrowed his eyebrows at Martin. Martin looked away quickly. Gwen nearly laughed out loud.
Thanks for the offer, Gwen said. It's sweet of you, but the last thing I need is any of these people thinking I have wizards helping me do my work. I have a hard enough time getting them to pay a fair price as it is.
What I don't understand is, if this is everyone in the village's clothes, what are they wearing now?
Philip asked.
Their other clothes, Gwen answered. Most of them own 2 full outfits, and they were very clear that they'll want me to work on the other when these are done. I told them I'd charge for the second set. That should cut down on the bulk. Anyway, enough about my problems. I bet you gentlemen are here to pick up the robe.
She put down her work and exited to a room at the back of the shop, leaving the two wizards alone for a moment.
How many shirts do you think you could have carried per trip?
Philip asked. I wouldn't want to try more than 2 or 3.
It would take many trips. You'd have had to spend quite a bit of time helping Gwen.
Yeah, Martin said. Probably.
I could have shown you a way to move them all at once.
I wouldn't have used it.
Martin, you're not dumb. Not at all.
Philip said, smirking in spite of himself. Gwen returned, carrying a bundle of the same rough cotton his fitting robe was made of. For a moment he feared that his finished robe was made of the same cheap material. Then he realized that the final robe and hat were simply wrapped in it for protection. Gwen sat the bundle on a bare patch of her work table, stepped aside, looked at Martin, and with a flourish motioned to him to unwrap the package. Martin unfolded the covering and lifted the robe so he could see it. The primary fabric was a highly reflective silver color with little flat pieces that reflected a surprising amount of light integrated into the weave. It sparkled and glittered as if Gwen had made the robe from the hide of a skinned disco ball. The trim was a lighter, less reflective fabric that matched the trim on Santo's mask. Martin was delighted. As he held it up, Philip grabbed Martin's staff and put the bust of Santo up against the robe. The colors were an almost perfect match. Philip gave Gwen a questioning look. She shrugged and looked at Martin.
Gwen, it's perfect, Martin said, holding the garment up to the light.
Gwen smiled at Philip. Philip shook his head and said,
Well done.
I was worried it might be too flashy, but from what I saw on Martin's first night in town, I didn't think too flashy would really be a problem.
Martin hastily shed the red loner robe and hat. Gwen held the new robe by the shoulders so Martin could easily slip it on. It fit perfectly and instantly felt like a part of him. The silver hat sat easily and comfortably on his head. The cone of the hat did not flop over completely, but instead bent back slightly. Unlike Philip's brimless hats, Martin's hat had a 3-inch brim, the color of his robe's trim. Martin spread his hands wide and looked down at himself. Gwen directed him to the mirror, which was really a highly polished sheet of metal, but it did the job.
What do you think?
She asked. Martin said,
I look bitchin'!
That's good,
Philip explained to Gwen. Martin wanted to strut back to the shop, but Philip had insisted that Martin teleport them instead. They thanked Gwen, then paid her a great many gold pieces. The fabric was not cheap, but she knew wizards were good for it. Martin put one hand on Philip's shoulder and held his staff aloft with the other hand. In his most impressive tone of voice, Martin said the magic words.
Transporti al Philip Boutico.
And they were standing in the front room of Philip's shop.
Good. The shell is recognizing the robe and hat. Gwen does excellent work, but nobody's perfect. It's always a good idea to test a new robe before you try to do magic in public. Try shooting a beam.
Martin pointed at a dead squirrel and a jar of yellowish fluid on the shelf and said,
Radion de Rouge Lumo.
A ray of red light shot from his hand, illuminating the jar, which was unfortunate. He moved his hand around, watching the beam track with the direction of his finger. After a moment, Martin said, Halty! And the beam stopped, as if someone had flipped a switch. Martin then tested the hat by producing two burritos for their lunch. As they sat in the crystal ballroom, enjoying their meal, Martin asked what was next in the training schedule.
Well, I've shown you all of the basics. Now we concentrate on getting you ready for the trials.
How long do you figure that'll take? Martin asked between bites.
2 days.
That's pretty specific,
Martin said as best he could while chewing.
Very specific,
Philip said.
Your trials are scheduled for 2 days from now.
After Philip had administered the Heimlich maneuver, Martin immediately started yelling, or would have if he'd caught his breath enough. Instead, Martin gasped emphatically.
What do you mean the trials are scheduled for 2 days from now?
He wheezed.
I don't know how to state it any more plainly than you just did,
Philip answered.
In 2 days, we are going to go to London. Jimmy, as the chairman, will throw a party in your honor, all the while referring to himself as Merlin. Try to enjoy the party. There will be many wizards you haven't met, pretty much every wizard in Europe. There'll be food and drinks, and many top-notch insults will be hurled at Jimmy by me. At the end of the dinner, you will show everyone the most impressive macro you can come up with. The next morning, you will face the trials. And by that night, you'll be a full-fledged wizard.
Martin smiled and said,
Thanks. Or naked and hog-tied in the back of a squad car.
Martin sneered and said, Thanks. Martin spent most of the next 2 days at Philip's house, hunched over his laptop. Philip would occasionally stop by to quiz him on his Esperanto, or to take him out for a quick practice flight, but most of the time was spent with Martin working on his macro, and Philip away at the shop, staying out of Martin's way. At one point, Martin had a question, and rather than just calling Philip, he decided to stretch his legs. He teleported to Philip's shop. After he materialized in the front room, the one designed to look like a shop, Martin thought about how easy it would be to become lazy as a wizard, and how much he looked forward to it. His eyes landed randomly on a small, ornate box, sitting among the other random objects Philip had placed on his shelves solely for their ability to look mysterious. The box was about 5 inches long, made of wood, and its proportions were similar to a coffin. It sat on tiny carved clawed feet. Its hinged lid and sides were decorated with carvings of dragons. He called Philip's name and got no reply. He tried again. Still no response. Humming quietly to himself, he moved cautiously into the crystal ballroom, around the table, and faced the door that led upstairs. The door that no person could open or enter but Philip. He knocked and waited several seconds. No reply. He knocked again. Martin decided Philip wasn't there. As he turned his back to the door upstairs, he noticed that the shelf built into the crystal ball table that usually held Philip's beloved Commodore 64 was empty. He looked into the crystal ball and saw that the TV was also missing. Martin was so engrossed in peering into the crystal ball, he didn't hear the door behind him open.
Can I help you, Martin?
Philip asked. Martin jumped, then tried to sound casual.
I just wanted to get out of the hut. I thought I'd come see what you're up to, Martin said.
I'm not up to anything,
Philip said as he stood framed by the open door, drying his hands on a modern hand towel. He was wearing his powder blue robe, but not his hat. The forbidden staircase stretched off into darkness behind him. Martin pointed to the empty shelf where the computer had sat. He could see a rectangular patch that was free of dust. Why'd you move the Commodore?
No reason, Philip said.
Oh, Martin said, as if that explanation simply hadn't occurred to him. The two men stood, looking at each other in silence for a moment.
Well, Philip said, you'd better get back to studying and working on your macro. Tomorrow we go to London, and the day after you face the trials. I'd hate to have to strip you naked, tie you up, and send you back to your time, especially the first two parts. Never pleasant.
Philip started closing the door as if Martin had already left. Martin raised his hand and cleared his throat like a schoolboy with a question.
Yes, Martin, what is it?
Philip said, now just poking his head through the partially closed door. Martin held up the small wooden box he'd taken from the shelf.
Mind if I make a copy of this to use?
It's your box, so I thought it'd be polite to ask first. Philip looked down at the box. For a moment, all irritation drained from his face.
Oh, that's the perfect size, isn't it? Make a safety copy or two if you like, but the box is yours. It's a gift. Take it and go home, Martin.
With that, Philip closed the door firmly. Martin knew not to knock again. Martin spent the rest of the day working on his macro. Philip had told him that the wizards would expect to see what they like to call a salutation, the set of effects used at the beginning of a duel, or when feeling threatened by the locals to show that everybody knows they've got a powerful wizard on their hands. The night he and Philip first met, the light show that ended with Martin flying backwards into the forest had been Philip's salutation. Wizards also use their salutation as a means of both entertaining and demonstrating their power and creativity. Philip had often called it the wizard's form of breakdancing. It was a dated reference, but Martin thought it fit. Martin asked Jeff some questions about his work on importing video game assets into the real world. Specifically, Martin wanted to know about displaying and animating three-dimensional assets in space and playing audio files. Later, he asked Gary about smoke, light, and particle effects. He had seen that Gary had a good grasp of the subject. Also, by not asking any one wizard all of his questions, he had a better chance of keeping his macro a surprise. He spent the rest of the day searching the web for code snippets and existing animations to speed up the process. He ran a simulation or two and was happy with the results. Philip returned from the forbidden zone above his shop at dusk, acting as if nothing had happened. They dined on burritos from Philip's magic burrito hat. Philip had many other food choices he could produce, but a selection of specialized burritos is all the variety most men need. After dinner, they went for a fly and found themselves back at the Rotted Stump, the inn where they'd first met. When they went in, Martin noted that the place looked exactly as it had when he first arrived, and yet it felt totally different. It seemed less hostile, less frightening. He figured it was partly because he was more familiar and comfortable with this era now, and partly because he knew he could level the whole building with a few words of Esperanto. Pete was behind the bar, wearing what appeared to be a windbreaker made out of used cling film. He had collected all of it from the patrons and had Gwen help him fashion it into a shirt, but it was devilishly hard to put on and take off, so he cut it up the front and used it as a jacket. He said it still turned inside out every time he took it off, but he just wore it inside out the next day, and because it was transparent, nobody could tell. Gert was also there. She greeted Martin in the friendliest way she knew how. She cracked her knuckles. Philip tried not to look too proud when, without any urging, Martin apologized to Pete and to Gert for the scene he'd caused on his first night in town and asked if he could do another trick to make up for it. He pointed to an empty flagon that was on the bar in front of Pete and said,
Culp you.
He repeated this 15 times, and 15 more flagons appeared on the table. Then he removed his hat and produced enough gold to pay for enough beer to fill all of the flagons. He announced that the next round was on him. Then he leaned in close to Pete and said,
Feel free to keep all of the flagons.
Pete replied,
You gonna help me wash them?
Do you wash the ones you already have?
Martin asked.
Good point,
20. The next morning, Martin woke early. He lay in his hammock, listening to nothing. He didn't often hear nothing. He had discovered that living in a medieval town was not much quieter than living in a modern town. Sure, cars make a lot of noise, but so do hooves. And while in a modern house the road noise is filtered through modern windows, but in the past it came through either rough, single-glazed glass or a simple hole with wooden shutters. It was quiet.